Okay. Fair enough. But I'll count on you to manage the discussion. Thank you. I've been asked to speak for 20 to 30 minutes, and this will be divided into two times. The first part, this is the title, Analysis of Energy Security and Geoeconomics. I won't say very much about geoeconomics as a concept. I think that you implicitly understand it as a construction on geopolitics with an emphasis on economics. The first half of what I have to say will be some remarks about so-called global energy governance, which is very much in style these days, especially with the December conference in Paris. And then I'm going to switch gears slightly, but still with some continuity, and speak about energy security, specifically the energy security of supply of energy to Europe, and in particular natural gas, which means I'll be making some remarks about the Eastern countries and Russia. Now, I should start by saying that with the launching of the Energy Union initiative, there are a lot of working groups trying to figure out what energy security is. It's a very complex topic. Usually it's treated as security of supply. However, if you're an energy producer, then energy security is security of demand. I'll come to that in a moment. In terms of energy security and global governance, critiques of the notion that energy security is a zero-sum game where you have supply and demand, and if one person has it, then one country has it, then another country doesn't. These kinds of critiques of this zero-sum approach tend to draw attention to institutions of the market and the rules of the game that structure them. And then, on the other hand, it is considered that policy elites may, quote, adjust these norms so as to promote the behavior by the publics that they wish to produce. In fact, so-called energy governance has become a cottage industry amongst energy researchers and policy analysts, concerned mainly with the global level. Focus best illustrated by the concern with establishing limitations on carbon emissions, which it does not fall into my charge today. Of course, the real situation is really more complex. There are at least two fundamentally different notions of energy security. One of them is framed in the market-centric terms of price and supply, while the other concerns such issues as availability, capacity, and sustainability. One view looks at energy security as the outcome of a self-regulating market, and the other sees energy security as a market outcome resulting instead from institutional arrangements and processes orchestrated by the actions and policies of the state or of supranational actors. More than that, these two notions of energy security of supply and energy security of demand are in fact subcategories of a larger category, which is the energy system as an object exposed to security threat, which omits another supercategory of the energy system as a subject generating or enhancing security. So that broadly conceived and possible to be divided into different spheres, energy security, arguably, discussions of energy security arguably must mention at least political risk factors, technological risk factors, and environmental risk factors, in addition to the zero-sum questions of energy security of supply and security of demand. Now, with those preparatory remarks, I wish to turn to the only for the second half. When I have maps for the second half. But the I wish to contrast two attempts to implement energy governance. one of them is unsuccessful and the other was successful. And why one was successful and the other unsuccessful introduces the topic of the security of gas. The Energy Charter Treaty was one such attempt to regulate overall norms of energy security. However, the Energy Charter Treaty failed to promote European, Ukrainian, Russian cooperation in the gas provision through Europe and the reform of the Ukrainian energy sector. I believe that I may leave some details of that for the questions, although what I will be presenting in the second part of my discussion of my presentation will be not so much about Russia, Ukraine, and Europe, but more about the Southern Gas Corridor. However, I think that you all know that there has been a failure to regulate the transmission of gas from Russia to Europe by way of Ukraine. And there are the details of that. I shall only say that in the mid-90s, the Yeltsin regime signed the Energy Charter Treaty but was unable to get it ratified by the Duma. And then, in fact, the failure of the South Stream pipeline is a logical consequence of this. Since the Energy Charter Treaty, the norms of the Energy Charter Treaty and those of the Third Energy Package of the European Commission are very much in line with one another. The main reason why it failed was that underneath all of the geopolitical and geoeconomic jockeying, you have geography and physical geography and geopolitics underneath it, so that Ukraine's legal obligations under the Energy Charter Treaty excluded the possibility simultaneously of joining the Russian-led Eurasian Customs Union on the one hand and the European Union on the other hand. Now, let me turn briefly to a success in the Southern Corridor region, but which was in the oil sector and not in the gas sector. And here I'm referring to the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, the so-called contract of the century, which is taking offshore oil from the Azerbaijan coast across Azerbaijan through Georgia and then south to the Mediterranean Sea, the port of Ceyhan of Turkey, and there from there export to the world market. Now, this was a rather remarkable feat. It was the first pipeline in the history of the industry that went through three countries: a producing country, a transit country, and the final exporting country. There were all kinds of issues that had never been encountered before for this reason, and some extremely creative juridical, organizational, institutional solutions, which I shan't inflict upon you, were found. There were four different agreements that had to be signed in Istanbul in November 1999, in the margin of an OSCE summit, amongst investors, governments, international financial institutions, and so on. And then the governments took these international agreements and incorporated them into the national law so that it became as like binding treaties to give the investor confidence in what was at that time, and still to some degree is, but not so much, a rather troublesome and insecure region. You know that the pipeline is pumping now at full capacity. There is oil coming across the Caspian Sea from Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan to Baku, Azerbaijan, and Makhachkala on the Russian coast and entering that pipeline and exporting 28% of it, 28% of Kazakhstan's export, in fact, out of there comes here to Europe, to Italy in particular. Now, I wish to conclude this section of the presentation by criticizing the academics who are so enamored of their capacity or what they think is their capacity to influence global policy, that when they conceive of energy governance, they have in mind only the global international level. In fact, the idea of a so-called boundary organization was invented by American political scientists. A boundary organization is basically a go-between between the policy experts and the policy makers, not just on an individual level, but they're actually not necessarily institutions, but organized networks of specializations where you get all of these reports, for example, every 4 or 5 years from the United Nations about global warming and so on. This is kind of the paradigm, in fact, of a so-called boundary organizations. What these people neglect to recognize is that the functions that they attribute to a boundary organization, which is to produce specialized expertise for the consumption of those making policy, actually is performed not only by academics, it's performed by government institutions, it's performed also by private firms in the energy sector. But because intellectuals have a habit of valorizing the role of intellectuals, they do not attend to the comparable activities of individuals outside academic institutions. That closes the first part of the presentation, and I move now to expand upon the Eastern questions in more detail, having alluded to the Russian, European, Ukrainian gas issue, which I can address further in the questions, and also indicating that it is necessary. This is the moral of that brief story, the failure of the one and the success of the other, that it's really necessary to take into account the geopolitical realities on the ground. It's necessary to take into account the lesson of the global level, because there's this notion that's been out there very popular in European Union and European Union studies for about 15 years, I'm sure you've heard of it, called multi-level governance. You find the best level of governance at which to treat this or that policy issue rather than assigning them a priori to this or that level. But multi-level governance has gone an orphan when it comes to energy governance. People who use the phrase energy governance are referring only to the global level and largely to environmental issues, whereas I hope I've at least been able to suggest that the physical to make physical production of energy and to transmit it and to consume it also occurs according to rules, according to legal norms, according to juridical facts on the ground that deserve also to be called energy governance, but they aren't, because different people are occupied with different things. The people who are producing the energy don't read the academics, and the academics who are advising the UN don't go to the Caspian and look at the oil rigs. So that having been said, moving to Europe and its gas. One hears the statistic that Europe is dependent 30% on Russia for its gas. This is largely true, but I'd like to nuance it. There you see total natural gas consumption, 510 billion cubic meters, and from Russia, imports of 155. Now, these statistics are happen to be from Gazprom, but they are, you know, they're not bad statistics. It's not because, and I'm not questioning them, but but what many people don't emphasize, and what I would wish to do, is that when Gazprom presents these statistics, it's for, as you see in the middle in the fine print, the EU28 plus Switzerland plus Turkey. Turkey is considered part of Europe in these statistics. Now, if one takes Turkey out of there, which is not a member of the European Union, then this 30% dependence upon Russian gas falls, in fact, to 25 to 26%. And if one also subtracts, as a special case from the mix, Germany, which has a special relationship with Russia and is highly dependent on Russian gas, then that dependence, in fact, falls to 22 to 23%. So I just wanted to mention that, first of all, in passing. But there you have some, and you see the other major importers, the other major sources are indigenous production, Norway, North Africa, and the Middle North Africa, mainly Algeria, and the Middle East, mainly Qatar. Now, this is not yet the Southern Gas Corridor, but this is to orient you, Russian gas pipelines to Europe. The dotted lines are lines that are not built or not yet built. The Nord Stream pipeline, for example, was originally designed with four, as they are called, strings, which is a string is a separate pipeline, usually carrying between 15 and 16 billion cubic meters a year of gas. Now, the Nord Stream was designed originally for 63 billion cubic meters, which is four strings, but only two have been built. So you see that up there on top, two of the lines are dotted. Many of these pipelines are, not all of them, are inherited from the Soviet period, and you see the Brotherhood or the Bratstvo pipeline feeding former Soviet bloc countries in particular, and then Southeastern Europe is not quite on the map. But it's on this map. And this map orients you concerning the South Stream and the Turkish Stream. If you have any further questions about it, I'll take them in the question period. But long story short, the South Stream was the pipeline that Russia sought to build underneath the Black Sea. They didn't know originally whether it was going to go to Bulgaria or Romania. It ended up going to Bulgaria. This has been in the headlines. You probably recall some of the details. The bottom line was that Gazprom wanted to build the pipeline on European territory, to own the pipeline on European territory, to send its own gas through the pipeline on European territory, and decide who else, if anyone else, had the right to send their gas through the pipeline that they owned. Well, that was a violation of the Third Energy Package on several accounts, and therefore it was not it was not it was not built. Now, so the quick fix that the Russians come up with is the so-called Turkish Stream pipeline, because notwithstanding the absence of of purchase contracts on the European side for their gas through the South Stream, the Gazprom actually signed contracts for the production of the physical pipeline, half by a German company, half by a Russian company, the Russian company being run by one of Putin's cronies. It's been going on for the last 15 years. And so they had this pipeline, this physical pipeline that's literally stored, has literally been stored in warehouses on the Bulgarian coast, and they couldn't use it for anything. And they were paying Saipem, which is a Japanese company, which is a subsidiary of Eni, the Italian energy company, which has very close ties with Gazprom. They were paying the very specialized Saipem pipe laying ships to sit there and do nothing because they couldn't lay the pipe. Well, so they come up with a Turkish Stream, which is the same project, ending, however, in Turkish Thrace rather than on the Bulgarian coast. And the trajectory of the pipeline would follow the old South Stream for the most of the Russian section of the seabed, and then instead of going into Bulgarian seabed territory, it would go into Turkish. Now, that still hasn't been signed yet because the Turks are bargaining very hard over the price. You see, of the gas, you see they already get gas from Russia through the Blue Stream pipeline, and also that pipeline would have to come on land in Turkish Thrace and go somewhere there, and they're very and Gazprom hasn't told the Turks, hasn't given them maps to tell them where they would like to get permission to build the pipeline on land. And that's why there is no yet not yet an agree a construction agreement signed. Not to mention environmental permits that the Turks must let for that purpose. There's a difference parenthetically between the offshore and the onshore. Maritime law provides that Turkey can delay but not refuse to let the permits for the offshore pipeline laying, but onshore is a different issue. So that's the South Stream and the Turkish Stream. The South Stream, the Turkish Stream projected capacity, again, is also 63 BCMY, billion cubic meters per year. Four strings, in my view, and I'll tell you why. If you ask me, they'll be lucky if two of them get built. One of them maybe even probably, maybe. They'll be lucky if two of them get built. So here we have a slightly more global or slightly more regional gas pipelines that are planned by 2018. You have the Nord Stream. This is a simplification you see of this map combined with that map. You have the Nord Stream, which I've discussed somehow in briefly, the so-called Yamal Europe pipeline from Yamal up in the Siberian, up in the Arctic area, the Urengoy Uzhgorod pipeline going through the Ukrainian border at Uzhgorod, and there you see the South Stream, the Turkish Stream, and the projected Blue Stream. So those are the gas pipelines more schematically than were shown before to Europe by 2018. Now, here you have a schematic of the quantities of the Russian gas supplies to Europe. This has changed a great deal from 2012 to 13 to 14. The first bar graph that you see is for 2012, and the second one is transit volumes in 2013. And you see that Nord Stream actually, in 2014, Nord Stream pumped only 29 BCMY out of a total billion cubic meters per year, out of a total possible capacity of 33, and out of a planned capacity, if all four strings were ever built, of 63. Then you see Yamal Europe, which goes through Belarus. The Blue Stream is the other Turkish pipeline that was built, entered into service about 15 years ago from Russia to Turkey. One more time. There it is, you see, ending in near Samsung in central northern Turkey. There we go, the Blue Stream. 16 is actually the capacity. It took a long time for that to ramp up from like 7 or 5 or 8 to about 13 or 14 now, because remember, those are capacities. Then the planned Turkish Stream, 63, and the Yamal Europe, 2, 15. And now the transit volumes there you see for 2013 are rather straightforward. The Blue Stream, as I mentioned, around 14. The Nord Stream has, in 2014, was 29 as opposed to 24 in 2013. And you see the lion's share of it goes through Ukraine. And I'm going to moving towards a conclusion now, which is not going to be a conclusion, but rather I should hope an opening up, these are the figures for the Russian gas transit to Europe and Turkey. Remember, I told you that Turkey is included in the statistics, although it's not part of the European Union, through 2014. And you can see already between 2013 and 2014 how much, I did not make this graphic, by the way, so I wished to draw your attention to the fact that it's been truncated, because it actually, zero is not here, zero is down here. It's one of those, you know, statistical tricks that people who draw graphs play. That drop is quite significant, but not as significant in percentage as it would look from the truncation of the of the graph on the bottom. But you can see that it's going down. It's going to still be going down further for 2015. And there you see also on the right side the share of the Russian gas transiting to Europe through Ukraine. That percentage is also been going down, and goes down still. And you know that Russia has stated that those transit contracts are in effect until the end of 2018, and you know that Russia has stated its intention to cease transiting gas to Europe through the Ukraine by that time, although there are some legal issues there, because some of the other transit contracts to, for example, Slovakia, do not end in 2018. That's another question. And for Turkey, you see Western Turkey gets about 14 BCMY through Ukraine, Romania, and Bulgaria. And that's what Turkish Stream, the first string of Turkish Stream, is supposed to replace. And this is why I say that we shouldn't be surprised if the first string gets built, because if Russia in fact turns off the taps of this so-called the Western or the Trans-Balkan route, Ukraine, Romania, which also feeds Romania and Bulgaria for that matter, Turkey, then, and if Turkey still does not have a substitution for that gas, then by coincidence, the quantity of the gas that Turkey receives through the Trans-Balkan route is equivalent to the volume of the first of the four Turkish stream strings, which is why the first one might get built. And so to conclude more or less on time, this is a key figure. Again, it's a couple years old, but hasn't changed much. It shows you which countries are the most dependent. And you see the Baltic countries, Finland, Slovakia, Hungary, Central Eastern Europe, Slovenia, Austria, Poland, and then, and so on. And that is the percentage. What that percentage is the percentage of import dependence on Russia. Not the total gas consumption, not the total energy consumption, but of their gas imports, what percent comes from Russia. So on that, I'll conclude. There are many other things that this opens up. New pipeline projects, the so-called East Ring project, the Nabucco West 2.0, and all those sorts of things if you're a pipeline aficionado, but I'll also answer any questions I can. You don't have to limit the pipelines. So I thank you for your patience. And Annette, please rejoin me.